Okay, so we'll finish up with a little bit about practical infrared spectroscopy and then get into NMR spectroscopy, which will take us several lectures. Today we'll talk about precession and imaging primarily. One thing I wanted to clear up, because I may have left an erroneous impression last time about the vibration. Here's that in-phase normal mode where their both bonds are stretching at the same time. And CC is stretching 9 times more than CO. But I exaggerated the amplitude in order to show that. What I wanted to give you the correct impression of is the real amplitude at which the atoms vibrate, which is what's shown here. Almost nothing, about 3% of the bond distance. Right, so it's a very subtle thing. And if you looked at the other one, the one where they're out of phase, we exaggerate it to show it's mostly the CO and just a little bit of the CC. And here it's minus 1/6 because one's stretching while the other is shrinking. So 6 times as much motion of CO as CC in that one. But the actual amplitude is just this. You hardly notice that the C double bond C is moving, or for that the C double bond O is moving, for that matter, that the actual vibrational amplitude is very small. And we talked about that last semester already in Lecture 8 when we were looking at vibrational wave functions. Okay, I just wanted to clear that up so you didn't have the impression that when molecules vibrated, the bonds were stretching like that. They're just going like that. You can hardly see it. Now a little bit about IR in the real world, the world of big money. And polymorphic multi-billion dollar pharmaceutical. Polymorphic means that the substance has different crystal forms. Notice that this is sort of like isomers, except they're all the same molecule, but they're just packed differently in a crystal. Right, and that's important in pharmaceuticals and in many applications because different solubility means different bioavailability. So if a substance suddenly changes its crystal form and becomes insoluble, it becomes useless as a drug. And this has happened to a very important AIDS drug that happened to about a decade ago. So these things, so different crystal forms can be patented. Not just different molecules. So that gives rise to interest of lawyers and patent people and so on. Now this is taken from a patent of this substance called paroxetine hydrochloride, which is Paxil, which is a drug that was a really big seller. There's the formula of it. We could look at the IR spectrum and see what we can see. It says polymorph A, so it's the IR spectrum of a solid. And because the molecules are packed in there differently, they'll vibrate a little differently, and you'll see different peaks for the same molecule in different crystals. Okay, so this is one of the forms that's involved in the patent. And you see there's the CH stretching frequency that you can recognize. Here's the fingerprint region, which is going to be different in complicated ways from one polymorph to another. And here, these peaks in this region happen to be due to an ammonium ion, the NH stretchings of an ammonia positively charged. So that's diagnostic in that region around 2500. It's very broad and complicated. But an interesting thing is these two peaks. What could be coming at really high frequency in this molecule? Any ideas? What gives peaks at high frequency in the IR? Mike? I can't hear it. Speak up. You mean the vibration involving oxygen?
Yeah.
No. Now, why not? Why can't a peak at very high frequency be a peak that involves stretching oxygen? Yeah, things that are at the main thing that determines where you are is the mass of the atoms, if it's hydrogen versus anything else. So it has to be stretching hydrogen. Now this is CH bond stretching, here's NH bond stretching. What could be giving these at really high frequency? If you have an XH stretch, then what determines the frequency? It's going to be at high frequency because it's H. But what in addition to that? Aromatic would indeed be higher because it's sp squared. It's a stronger bond. A stronger bond will give a higher frequency. But it's not that much stronger. What's a stronger bond with H? Have anybody seen peaks like this in their spectra in the lab? I bet so. Evan? If it were HCl, it might, but you don't have HCl in here. Yeah?
Is it the H attached to the C in the ether?
No. Kathy?
Is it water?
It's water. Didn't any of you ever have water in your IR spectra? Right? And this is especially interesting that it's water because, well, there are two peaks for water, right? Because some of the OHs are not hydrogen bonded and some of them are hydrogen bonded and therefore stretch more easily because as they get further from this one, they get closer to that one, right? So these are hydrogen bonded. These are not hydrogen bonded, but it's clearly water. See what's interesting about that from the title of this? It says it doesn't have water in it, but you can just look at the IR spectrum and see that it has water. So that was a little silly. Anyhow, that's the patent, the IR spectrum for form A. Here's form B, which also has the ammonium ions. No water this time, at least that one's dry. And again, you see the CH stretch and the fingerprints. And here's form C. In making form C, they put too much sample in. Did any of you do that in lab with your IR so that no light gets through or very little light? In fact, when you look at the CH peaks there, you don't see them because this is zero. No light's getting through. If you put enough stuff in, no light will get through any place. Okay, so this wasn't a very good spectrum, really. And again, it has a fingerprint region. Now we can compare these fingerprint regions to see if we can distinguish a patented forms from unpatented forms, so you know, or a form on which the patent has run out, the time is gone, so that anybody can make it. Okay, there's one. There's form C, there's form A, and for certain peaks for that, and there's form B, and there are peaks for that. And it's a pain in the neck to try to tell which one you have, especially if they're a mixture. Right? So you might look through here, and the patent did not do this carefully, to say just which peaks you'd look for to see whether you can really tell one of these forms from another. Right? And it turned out in the law court that what was important was these two peaks. Because it turned out that the form B that gives this 675 peak was covered by, was patent protected. And form A, 665, was not patent protected. So a generic drug company was trying to make this stuff that had 665. But the people that had the patent on form B said, if you have as much as 5% of that in there, then you can't sell your stuff because it's the stuff that I'm protected for. Okay? So the question was, if you have just 5% of this blue stuff in the presence of red, can you tell it by the IR spectrum? Right? So that was an interesting question. Okay, so there's IR in the practical world, if you call that practical. Okay. Now, spectroscopy for structure and dynamics is what we're focusing on, not for analytical things, for seeing whether you can see 5% of form B in the presence of form A, but to try to understand the structure and the dynamics of molecules. And we talked about electronic spectra already and vibrational as much as we're going to. And now we're going to go on to NMR, which involves radio frequency, light, and magnetism. And precession, which is a very counterintuitive phenomenon. Now, there's some problems about precession that you can do on the web page, and they'll be fun to do. Why don't you hand them in after vacation? Okay, so here's Michael Faraday, who, as you remember, was a chemist. And he's the guy who discovered benzene. And we're going to show that the NMR spectrum, the magnetic resonance spectrum of benzene, is very interesting. Right? But Faraday also discovered magnetic induction and invented the idea of fields. He showed that magnetism comes from accelerating electricity, and electricity comes from changing magnetism. And if you want to see a demo of that, you can see this website. And 30 years later, James Clerk Maxwell built these ideas of the fields into a comprehensive theory of light and magnetism and electromagnetism, and brought all these things together and united several of the most important fields in physics. But precession is at least as complicated and maybe as challenging to understand as the at first glance as magnetism is. You know how a top, when you spin it, doesn't fall down, it goes around and around. So why does something fall around rather than falling down under the influence of gravity just because it's spinning? If we took a bicycle wheel here, and I need a sky hook to fasten it onto. And I hook this on here. There we go. Do it this way. Take the mountain to Muhammad. There we go. Okay, so if I have it sitting here like this and hold up this end, there it is. But obviously, if I let go, it'll go down because it's being twisted. The string is pulling up, gravity is pulling down, and it twists and go down. The rim goes down because this twist is transferred through the spokes to the rim. So at the top, there's a force that points that way. Right? At the bottom, there's a force that points this way from this twist. So it falls down. Big deal. Okay? But what's interesting, and we can see that here, right? Falls down. Nobody's, can I see the hands of those who are surprised? What's surprising is what happens if it's spinning. Okay, and you've seen this, you've all played with tops and gyroscopes, but it's fun to watch, and we'll do a little bit of an experiment here. And now if I let go, it doesn't fall down. It falls around. Okay? So that's kind of weird, right? So here what we see is that if I have the thing spinning, what happens is the front moves one way and the back moves the other, and it goes around instead of falling down. That doesn't stand to reason. Okay? And in fact, the authority in physics, Feynman's lectures on physics, says about this, many simple things. Have any of you studied this in physics already and talked about torques and angular momentum and such like? That is not satisfying the way they talk about it in physics, right? And what Feynman says about that is many simple things can be deduced mathematically more rapidly than they could be really understood in a fundamental or simple sense. The precession of a top looks like some kind of miracle involving right angles and circles and twists and right-handed screws, but why not left-handed screws? Why should it be right-handed, right? What we should do is to understand it in a more physical way. So I want you to understand how this works. So we're going to do a couple experiments. Okay, now, so it's been going around and around. Let me, friction will have slowed a little bit, so let me speed it up a little bit. Okay, now, how fast is it going around? Let's see how long it takes. Here it's pointing toward you. 13 seconds roughly to make a circle, right? Now, what would happen if I made it heavier by putting this on here? I have a little hook I can fasten it to. Okay. It's going to go faster or slower around? It's going twice as fast. 1001, 1002, 1003, 1004. 2005. So the more I twist it, the faster it goes around. Okay? Now how about if I spin it faster or slower? Will it go around faster or slower? What do you think? Suppose I spin it faster. Will it go around slower or faster? How many say slower? How many say faster? Boy, that's 50-50. That's what makes a horse race. Okay, there it is. That's how fast it's going. And now I'll slow it down a bit. Can you see? Slow it down some more. Who won? Is it faster or slower now? It's considerably faster. I think it's twice as fast. Right? Much faster. Okay? Isn't that weird? You don't think it's weird? I think it's weird. Okay, let's see if we can understand this. Not in terms of angular momentum and torque and stuff like that and right-handed rules. Why not left-handed rules? Right? But in terms of what's actually pushing on what. Okay, so let's first look at the force. The force comes from the spring and gravity twisting it, and therefore the rim of the wheel feels forces. Where does it feel the strongest force to the right in this way of doing it? Where is the field strongest to the right? Where on the rim? Up at the top. Right? It's to the right at the top, to the left on the bottom. Here and here there is no force right and left. Everybody agree on that? So above center there's a force to the right, below center there's a force to the left because of the twist. Right? And so it's going to look like that. It's sinusoidal. Okay, for any given point on the rim. Okay, so that's clear. The force is strongest at the top. Now, here's the next question. Where is the rightward velocity going to be the greatest? Okay. The force is clearly the greatest at the top, the force to the right. Okay? Comes from the spokes trying to move the rim. Okay, the force is obviously greatest at the top, to the right and to the left on the bottom. Nothing at zero. So how many think that the velocity is the highest at the top?
Are we assuming that it's spinning?
Not spinning. Let's say not spinning, and you just let it go. How many say the top? Okay, good. How many say the bottom? How many say at zero? Okay. Well, you'd think the velocity is going to be greatest where the force is greatest, where you're pushing it the most. Now suppose it's spinning. Now, where will the velocity, according to the force we see, where will the velocity be the biggest? To the right. At the top, you're pushing to the right. At the bottom, you're pushing to the left. Where is the velocity of the rim going to be fastest to the right? Derek?
Would it be the back?
Why at the back?
Because it's just spinning around so that you have to use the other section.
Well, you're taking what you observe from the precession and saying it must be going that way. I'm saying, why is it going that way? Or maybe I misunderstood you, but I think that's what you did. Because you went like this, the way the bicycle wheel went. Suppose I keep pushing on something all the time, start at a given time, and I push with a constant force for 5 seconds. When is it going the fastest? At 1 second, 2 seconds, 3 seconds, 4 seconds, 5 seconds. I'm pushing all the time, constant force. When's it going the fastest? At 5 seconds. It keeps accelerating the whole time. Okay? So where on the rim, when it's spinning toward us here, where has it been pushed to the right for the longest time?
Back, because
no, it's spinning toward us.
Then the front.
Right, because it started being pushed to the right when it was at the back, when it rose up, okay, to be above center. And it's being pushed all the time, stronger and stronger until you get to the top, then weaker and weaker, but always to the right it's being pushed. So obviously, then, the accumulated rightward velocity, it's accumulating it all this time, and the maximum rightward velocity is when you're in front. Does everybody see that? So we can plot it here. So where has it been pushed to the right for the longest time? When it's in front. Okay? Now, so that's the point. When it's in front is when it has the maximum velocity to the right. Here's where it has the maximum force to the right. Here's where it has the maximum velocity to the right. Okay? And now, what will happen as it keeps going? As it keeps rotating? It's in the front now, and it's going as fast as possible to the right. That's this green arrow. What happens when it gets below center as it keeps rotating? Will, what do you say? Which way is it being pushed when it's below center? It's being pushed to the left. So what? But it's going to the right very rapidly. So what's going to happen? It'll start slowing down. It's like a brake on it. Until when it gets to the bottom, it's stopped moving to the right. And now it's going to pick up, stop moving to the right. Now it's going to pick up going to the left. Right, so now it's going to pick up going to the left, and it's going to reach its maximum leftward velocity, the yellow area, when it gets there. The yellow arrow. Okay, so it's going to go like that with the velocity. Maximum to the left, and then as it keeps rotating, it goes back where it started. Does everybody see that? There's nothing magic about it. The only thing that confuses you is that there's a phase difference between force and velocity. Force is not the same as velocity. It's velocity is sort of the accumulated force. Okay? So this 90 degree phase lag between force and velocity means that instead of falling down, which was what happened if the maximum velocity to the right was at the top, it has its maximum velocity to the right here. It falls because of this twist, but it falls around rather than falling down. Isn't that cute? So from here on, you'll understand when you spin a top. You know, the test for your physics friends who've learned this in a physics class is to, without using their hands, so they do right-handed rule, left-handed rule stuff, ask them, if I spin it this way, it's going to precess. But is it going to precess this way, or is it going to precess this way? And if you think through this, you'll get it right. Okay? Okay, so that's it. Now, here are nuclei. And these are nuclei that have spin, common nuclei. Many, many nuclei and isotopes of nuclei have spins, right? But we know that these particular nuclei spin, and the reason we know they spin is because they're magnetic. Their charge is rotating, accelerating, and therefore they generate a magnetic field. Faraday would have known that. And how do you know they're magnetic and spinning? Because if you put them in a magnetic field, which tries to twist them to line up with the field, what do? If they're spinning and they feel a torque, they precess. So it's the precession of the nuclei that shows that they're spinning and that they have magnetism. And so here are common ones, and I've ranged them in the order of how fast they precess. How fast they precess depends on how much spin they have, but that's a standard value. It's 1/2 for all the nuclei I've shown there. There are others that have different values, like 3/2, but or 1, but these have 1/2. Don't worry about why it's called a half. But all of them have the same spin, but they have different magnetic moments because they have different amounts of charge that's doing the spin. And it's complicated and involves the neutrons too, and that's not our business to understand nuclear physics. But at any rate, they have the same spin but different torque because they have different magnetism, right? And therefore they precess at different rates. This is the rate at which they precess in a field of about 23,500 Gauss. The magnetic field of the Earth is about 1 Gauss. right? So 23,000 Gauss. This is how fast they process in megahertz, in millions of times per second. Right, and I chose that field because that's about the biggest field you can get with a conventional electromagnet, you know, winding wire around. So it's a big magnet, you know, like this, to get a field that big. But anyhow, this is how fast they would go. So for reference, Connecticut Public Radio is 90.5 megahertz and WCBS is 0.8 megahertz, 8800 kilohertz. Or no, 880 kilohertz, 0.88 megahertz. Okay, and it turns out that an electron is a much stronger magnet. It also has a spin of a half, the same as these nuclei, but it's 660 times stronger than the proton, which is the smallest of these, the strongest of these. Okay, now let's look at frequencies of what this is, what energy is involved. So a megahertz, if you multiply by 3 times 10 to the minus 5, gives the value in wave numbers. Now, in IR, we've been talking wave numbers, thousands of wave numbers for the energy that's involved in the vibration. This is 100 megahertz, and a megahertz is only 3 times 10 to the minus 5th wave numbers. And if you wanted to do it if you wanted to transfer into units of temperature, you multiply wave numbers by 2.9. So that says 100 megahertz, what the proton does in the biggest field that it's convenient to get with an electromagnet, is about 0.003 wave numbers, right? Whereas the hydrogen vibrating in a bond is 3,000 wave numbers. So this is really a teeny, teeny amount of energy that's involved in this precession phenomenon. Now, if you have spin one half, it turns out that there are two angles that the thing can make. It, you know, with my bicycle wheel, I could have made it at any angle I wanted. Right? Although it's interesting, we could do the experiment if you want to stay after, or maybe you want to go on vacation, I don't know. But it turns out that the precession frequency doesn't depend on the angle. It's the same frequency of precession, whatever the angle is. That's one of the problems on your problem set. Okay? But there are only two angles possible for a thing that has spin one half, or three for something that has spin one. Okay, so there are two angles that are possible. Now, one of them points mostly up, one of them points mostly down. And the difference between those two at room temperature is this frequency. Okay? So if you look at what the thermodynamic advantage is for being with, you know, a compass needle points with the field of the Earth, right? It'll rotate to point north. That's the low energy. How much energy difference is there for this magnet to point with, more or less with, rather than more or less against the field? The difference in energy is this, if we work in Kelvin here for numerator and denominator, it's 0.01, and at room temperature 300. So the equilibrium ratio is 1.00003. That is, that there are, and if you have 200,000 of these nuclei, there are three more pointing up. There are an excess of three pointing up out of that. So it's a very tiny thing. So if responses are going to be due to how much more there is of one than the other, the net magnetism is how much more there is of one than the other, it's really, really tiny. It was very different in IR, where because there was a big energy difference, at equilibrium everything is down in this level. And if you put light in, it'll absorb and go up here. Had things all been up here, you put light in, and they'll go down. It'll be like a laser and give off energy. If they were the same, there'd be no net interaction with light, the same number going up and down. In IR, it wasn't a problem. Everything was down here at equilibrium, so it absorbs. But here, there are only 3 in 2,000 more in the low level than in the high. So signals are going to be very weak because there are almost as many going down as going up when it interacts with the light. So that's an important feature. Okay, furthermore, I made these in red because these aren't the normal isotopes of oxygen. Oxygen is usually 16, right? 6% of oxygen is oxygen 17, and 1% of carbon is carbon 13. So that makes it even weaker when you put a sample in there. If you're looking at carbon 13, only 1% of them are that. And the energy is very much less than it was here. For here, there are that many more at equilibrium. Here, you're only, what, a fifth of the way up or something like that, so it'll be five times fewer. So these are going to be really wimpy signals. Okay? But they're arguably the most important. Protons, fortunately, are 99.98 in that, not deuteron or tritium. Okay, now how does it work? How does the light get generated or absorbed in this system? So we put on an applied magnetic field, and the spin 1/2 nucleus is oriented, because it can have only two orientations, at an angle to it, either with, that's the lower energy, or against the field. But it's spinning, so what happens? The field is trying to line it up, puts a torque on it, but it's spinning, what happens? It precesses. Okay, so the precession in this field we were talking about is 100 megahertz, right? So it goes around that cone. Okay, now over time, then it has a constant vertical field, right? So the component of this field along the direction of the applied field is constant, but there's also a component that's rotating as it goes around. Does everybody see that? Okay. And that's rotating at 100 million times a second. Okay. Now, will that rotating horizontal field generate a radio frequency thing? You know, shifting electrons back and forth like this does it. But a magnetic field changing can also do it. So if you have a magnetic field that's going like this, that's as good, or sort of as good, as electrons sloshing back and forth. So that would be like an antenna and generate radio frequency signals, 100 megahertz signals. Everybody with me? But it doesn't do it. And the reason it doesn't do it is quite obvious when you come to think about it, that there's not just one nucleus there. There's Avogadro's number of nuclei, or something close, and some of them are—they're in all different phases of rotation. So their vertical components all reinforce, okay? But their horizontal components cancel out. So there isn't any net broadcasting from the protons in you or the C13s, okay? So the horizontal fields cancel. Now, can you do anything about it so that you get a horizontal field that doesn't cancel? You can. And this is where we get to what's called the rotating frame. And it's a neat, really neat trick that people who do NMR use. So consider a rotating frame in which the observer orbits at 100 megahertz. I mean, you'd get quite dizzy if you did that. But you can imagine it. So you're looking at these protons, but you're zinging around at 100 megahertz. Okay? Now what do they look like to you? They look like they're just standing still because they're all going at the same rate. Right? So in the rotating frame, if you rotate at that same frequency, everything looks stationary. It's as if you didn't have a big magnetic field, as far as you can tell, if you're rotating, other than the fact that you're getting dizzy. Okay? So they just look like they're standing here. So it's as if there's no applied field. Okay, now here's what you do that's neat. You put on a magnetic field in this direction, in the rotating frame. That means, in truth, the field is going around, the field you're putting on is going around at 100 megahertz. But for purposes of understanding, you're zinging around at 100 megahertz, so both the field and the nuclei appear to be standing still. Everybody with me? Okay. So, and how do you put on something that goes around 100 megahertz? You put a radio frequency signal in that's going like that with its magnetic field. Okay, so that's no problem. Okay, so that's... Now, what will those things do, those nuclear magnets, if they see a horizontal field? That horizontal field will try to twist them to line up with them. Will they say, yes, boss, and twist in the direction it wants to, or what will they do? they'll precess. But they'll precess in this, around this field, as long as we're in the rotating frame and can ignore the main field. Okay? So they're going to precess like this. But it'll be a very slow precession compared to the 100 megahertz because we didn't put on a very strong field, not like this biggest field you can get with an electromagnet. Okay? So they're only precessing at 0.1 megahertz. Now here's the trick. We're going to pulse this field here. We're going to put it on only for a short time, only long enough for that set of nuclei that appear to be standing stationary. We're only going to put it long enough that they rotate down by 90 degrees. Okay? That's called a 90 degree pulse, surprisingly enough. Okay, so we put on a 90 degree pulse, just long enough to rotate all the nuclear spin axes by 90 degrees. And instead of looking like that, it looks like that. Everybody got it? They were like that. And now, if we look at it in the rotating frame, they've done like that. What are they actually doing? This was all in these considerations here were all in the rotating frame. Let's go back to the lab frame now. We've seen that what happens is we turn these down like that. But what are they doing in the lab frame? They're going like this. Right? 100 megahertz. So, if we now go back into the lab frame, these are going to be precessing about this field at 100 megahertz. So it's going to go like that. What's neat about this? Now there is a net magnetization that's going back and forth. Okay? There wasn't when it was like this because the horizontal components canceled one another. But now you've got that former vertical component, where they all reinforced going around. So now you've got this thing broadcasting a radio signal and you can listen to it with an antenna. Okay, so you get 100 megahertz radio frequency in the lab frame after you've done this 90 degree pulse. Okay? Until, in time, it'll reach equilibrium again after you've done the pulse. So it'll come back, and ultimately it's going to go back where ultimately it's going to go back where you started from here, right? But until then, you're going to be getting this radio signal out. And that will tell you how fast they're precessing. So a 90 degree pulse makes the spinning nuclei broadcast a frequency that tells what their local magnetic field is. The reason they're precessing is because of the local magnetic field. The bigger the field, when we put the wrench on, the faster they go. Right? So these things are little probes that tell you what the local magnetic field is. Now, what good is that? It's good for magnetic resonance imaging, which is to locate protons or other nuclei within the body using a non-uniform field. Now, the way we do this, the idea of this came to Paul C. Lauterbur, who died just 3 years ago. This was his obituary in the New York Times, and you can read a little bit about it there if you want to on your own. He discovered it in a place you can see if you get up on top of Klein Tower at Stony Brook University across the Sound. And to think how this works, you could imagine another experiment where there are crickets hidden in this room, but it's dark, you can't see them, but you can hear them chirping. How can you tell where they are if all you can do is hear them? Does anybody know what's great about crickets chirping? Yeah? If you squash them, they stop too. But that's not the most interesting thing, perhaps. Yeah.
They chirp at different rates at different temperatures.
They chirp at different rates at different temperatures, right? So if I put ice at this side of the room and heating, electric heating at that, so there was a gradient across the room, and I listened to the crickets, how fast they're chirping tells what temperature they're at. And that tells where they are in the room if I have a gradient of temperature across the room, right? So I'd establish a temperature gradient and listen with a stopwatch, right? And see how rapidly they chirp. And if you want, there's a website that tells you how to tell the temperature from how fast crickets chirp, right? So that would tell how far they are from left to right. How would I know how far they are from front to back? Yeah. make the fire up here and the ice back there, right, and see what temperature they're at. Then I'd maybe do it from, they might be on the wall, I'd do it floor to ceiling. So if I do it in a lot of different dimensions, then I can find out exactly where these crickets are. Everybody see how that works? Pretty straightforward. Okay, but you can do the same thing with protons. And this is, so you can do tomography this way. Now this particular website that has this, which is linked down at the bottom right there, it does it with x-rays. But the general idea is you tell how many from front to back. So here's somebody's rib cage and spine, and I don't know what they're wearing around them that blocks x-rays. But anyhow, we're going to take x-rays, scan from top to bottom, right, and see how much stuff there is at every height. This is like how many crickets there are from left to right in the room. Okay? So I get this information out, which is the projection of this onto that line. Right? So that's how many from left to right, but we don't have the information about front to back, top right to bottom left, and so on. Right? So the way you do it is really neat. So you spread that out. Okay? And then you rotate the sample and do the same experiment again and add it to the one you already had. Everybody see what we did? And now we rotate it by another 15 degrees and add it, and another 15 degrees, and another 15 degrees, and keep going. Isn't that neat? So that's how you do with the crickets, right? But you can do the same thing with protons. Okay? All you have to do is make different magnetic fields at different parts of the sample and listen to hear how fast they're precessing. They'll be broadcasting different frequencies at their different local fields. Right? And then you do it in different directions. So here's an MRI machine. Right? And what we have is a main field caused by all these coils along here that goes in this direction. Right? And that's a constant field. But then we make a gradient in the field, make it different in different parts. For example, we want to find where water is, say. That's where a lot of protons are, okay, in the body. Okay, so from this coil here and this coil here, we make a gradient along Z. So it's not what these coils did, which was to make it uniform along Z. We make it a higher field at the feet than at the head. Right? And now we find out where water is from foot to head. Right? And then we crank up these yellow coils here that go from front to back or top to bottom. And we find out where the protons are in that dimension. And then with these coils, we make it left to right different. Okay? And this thing here is a radio antenna that listens to what frequencies are being broadcast during each of these experiments. And you can do lots and lots of different combinations of these coils to get gradients in any direction you want and add them all together the way we did with the tomography experiment, and you get where the water is in the body. Now there's a neat version of that which is called functional magnetic resonance imaging. It was originally called nuclear magnetic resonance, which is of course what it is. The nuclei are what's processing. But they changed it to call it magnetic resonance imaging. Why? Yeah? Because people were scared of going into a machine that was called nuclear. Right? Okay, so anyhow, MRI. But functional MRI is very interesting. So you locate protons whose signal strength is being fiddled with. Okay, now let me show you how you might fiddle with it. So, for example, there's this thing called BOLD imaging, B-O-L-D, blood oxygen level dependent imaging. Because it turns out that when oxygen is near a proton, they behave different because oxygen is magnetic, and they'll relax faster. Or relax slower or whatever. It'll change their relaxation rate. That's how fast the signal goes away. Remember, they were going like this, but given time, they'll all line up again. How fast that happens depends on how much oxygen there is around, right? But in the brain, when a cell is being used, it demands more oxygen. So the relaxation time, the signal will be fiddled with for that cell because there's more oxygen there if that cell's being used. Okay? So you'll be able to detect that. And with this, you can get spatial resolution of about 1 millimeter You can tell cells apart that are a millimeter apart, or groups of cells. And you can get time resolution within, you can see changes within 2 seconds in doing this. Okay, now as I said here, cell activity increases blood oxygen supply, which increases relaxation, which changes the signal, and you can detect that change in signal. For example, you can look at this in different slices through the brain, right, it, where X is zero, the plane where X is zero, or where Y is zero, or where Z is zero, or some combination of them, right? And you can do it when the patient is looking at donuts. And then you can do it when the patient is looking at car keys. And there's a difference in which cells are firing when you look at donuts and when you look at car keys. And you can see where in the brain that these cells are that are different between donuts and car keys. Okay? And what's really interesting is that that's when people have been fed recently, and this is when they have fasted. So the difference between donuts and car keys becomes really big if you haven't eaten lately. Okay, so there are lots and lots of experiments that have been done like that. I mean, they do in the medical school here, for example, but lots of places are doing this functional magnetic resonance imaging. But that's not the main thing we're interested in. We're interested in molecules, or maybe you're interested in donuts or brains or whatever, but for purposes of this course, we're interested in molecules. So we want to locate protons within molecules. Now, you'd think we'd need a fantastically gradated field in order to get different broadcasts from one part of a molecule and another to have a different field. That's, of course, impractical. You can't have it change that rapidly. So what you do is exactly the opposite. You make the field fabulously uniform, so it's the same everywhere, and you don't have any of these differences due to whether the cricket is here or here, because the temperature is absolutely the same everywhere. So all protons should now be the same, broadcast the same frequency. A proton is a proton. Okay, now, how can we do it with a uniform field? Well, we listen in the original experiments, which were different from the way we do it now, which is what I've described, where you listen to all different frequencies and find out where things are. Originally, there was just one radio listening at a particular frequency, tuned to just one frequency, and what you did was change the magnetic field. So as you increase the magnetic field, the precession gets faster and faster and faster until you get to the field that's that field for your protons, right? That corresponds to what your radio is listening to. So what we're going to do is show an oscilloscope trace where we increase the magnetic field until we get to just the right field to have the protons broadcast at the frequency that our radio is tuned to. Okay, so here we go. And there's the right field. Wait, there's the right field. No, there's the right field. Different protons in this are having different precession frequencies. Or to have the same precession frequency, they need different fields. A proton should be a proton. Right? So this is, now the difference as we go from here to here is not big. In fact, from here to here, the fractional difference in how big the field is 0.0000248. That is 2.48 parts per million. Almost no difference at all. Notice that the original field over the sample of ethanol has to be fabulously uniform. Otherwise, different parts of the sample would spread way out, right? Like magnetic resonance imaging, and you wouldn't get sharp peaks like this. But if you make the field fabulously uniform to within a hundredth of a part per million or better, then you can see this difference that was called chemical shift, because this was to disparage the thing, because the physicists were doing this. They thought chemistry is schmemistry, right? This, everything should be the same. There's something chemical going on. We'll forget that. And we don't have to worry about it. It's only 2 parts per million anyhow. But anyhow, it's due to chemistry. Okay? this requires very high uniformity of field to avoid doing magnetic resonance imaging to get different peak, to have these all broaden out because they're coming from different parts of the sample. Now, three peaks, why do we get three peaks? Yeah, why? There are three different kinds of protons, methyl, methylene, and OH. So already that's good. You can see how many different kinds of protons there are in a sample, if you're lucky. Okay, what time we got here? Let me just see what the next one is. We'll go on to Dr. Lauterbur next time, okay? Have a good vacation. What about it?
I liked your precession explanation.
Good.
It actually kind of illuminated. I took an NMR class, theory class in undergrad, and it kind of illuminated certain unclear points at the very beginning of that class.
So. Oh, really?
Good.
It's sort of a weird amalgam of the sort of quantum and classical views of that sort of thing.
Yeah.
That's, I don't know.
That's right, though.
When we have this rotating frame.
Yeah.
Does that mean all the molecules, all the atoms are spinning in one direction?
Yeah, the nuclei all spin the same direction.
Really?
That's a fundamental property of nuclei.
Okay.
You might imagine that some would spin to the right and some would spin to the left. That's not true. They all spin the same way. Although, all of a given kind, some nuclei spin the other way. I forget, some of them have negative angular momentum, some have positive. But all protons are the same, all deuterons are the same, all nitrogens. I think maybe nitrogen is negative. It turns out it doesn't make much difference, but they can be of either side.
So the energy difference is whether they're spinning this way or this way.
Yeah, whether they're lined up more or less with the field or more or less against the field. That's different energies. But whether they're precessing to the right or left wouldn't make any difference.
Based on the lecture, I don't see how that matters, whether they're...
Oh, that's just a magnetic interaction between, you know, it's like a compass with the field. A compass lined up with the field is better than a compass lined up against the field. That's what it means for the field to put a torque on the thing, trying to make it go to lower energy.
But you said the difference is very small, but does that even matter for MRI? It seems like that you have these, some are spinning this way and some are spinning the same way.
Oh, where it makes a difference is that if you had equal numbers up and down, then no matter what you would do, you know, 90 degree pulse or whatever, they'd cancel one another. But there are a few more pointing up than are pointing down. So when you turn both families into the plane by doing a 90 degree pulse, there's not a right to left cancellation. Do you see what I mean? Because there are three more out of 200,000 this way than there are that way. So there was a very weak net magnetization parallel to the field before you did the pulse. After doing a pulse, there's that same weak magnetization, horizontal and precessing. And that's what broadcasts the signal.
So this is the fast spin. Like, let's say nothing is applied. This is the fast spin. And then
Fast precession.
And then when we take it down, this becomes the fast precession.
No. The fast precession is always around the big field. But for our purposes of thought and analyzing the circumstances, we could, if we spin or orbit at that same frequency, we can forget the big field. So we forget the big field. That's for purpose of understanding what the pulse does, that it turns things down. So that's why we did the rotating frame, was to understand what a 90 degree pulse does. But really, that was just for thinking. Always they're precessing at 100 megahertz in the sample, in the field we were talking about.
Okay.
But the difference was that originally there was no net field horizontally precessing because there were all different orientations, canceling each other out. But once you do the pulse and rotate them down, now that little, that small net magnetization you had because of the tiny energy difference between favorable and unfavorable, that very small net magnetization now is precessing. And that's where your signal comes from.
Okay.
Until it relaxes. Okay?
So don't actually just...
Yep.